Hello, this is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel #LinuxShow. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show, or maybe you're thinking about it, I don't know. This is probably a commercial. You want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out at www.linuxshow.com for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
It is The Linux Show for February 11th, 2003. We're back again for another weekly episode, bringing you the latest and greatest news of what's going on in Linux and open source. Miracle, miracles, we got the whole crew tonight, and we're going to catch up from taking our little short hiatus last week. I'm hoping everybody who did stop by the show last week enjoyed our special segment honoring the crew of the Columbia. It's a subject that's very, very near and dear to my personal universe. And so I hope you took the message with the same deep feelings that Kevin and I put into it, putting it together for you. So we're going to go ahead, because we've got 2 weeks worth of news to catch up on. We're going to go ahead and jump right into the first segment without wasting any time. Arnie, I know you got a ton, so why don't we go over to you first and pick up one of your stories. What's your hot stories of the last
week? Let's see, I'm trying to get them in the same order they are on the Linux search website. First article is from PC World, which is a.k.a. Computer World. Is Linux on the desktop inevitable? Creator of the alternative operating systems is coming to business for desktops, and he's getting plenty of support. That's a tagline. The widespread use of Linux on the desktop hasn't caught on so far, but don't count it out quite yet. A new group, the Linux Desktop Consortium, is being formed by a growing number of Linux and application vendors to promote the use of the open source operating system on corporate and home desktops. Others have tried the concept before, including Dell, which several years ago offered several desktop computer models with Red Hat Linux pre-installed. It didn't catch on, though, and Dell dropped the pre-configured machine because demand was lacking, but also was promotion was lacking, I might add. Dell didn't seem to promote it very heavily, and they didn't offer it on. They offered it only on their big machines instead of offering it on the inexpensive machines where Linux might sell. But back to the article, but a lot has changed in recent years, including the addition of more robust enterprise-ready features in the latest versions of the operating system, as well as a wider range of business applications. More expensive licensing for Microsoft's dominant Windows operating system.
Arnie.
Yeah.
We don't need to read him the article.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
The business is available.
Anyway, this article, I'm just reading a small excerpt, though. This article basically is it talks about this new desktop consortium that Linus has put
acceptance on.
Yeah, he said it's okay. He's part of the deal, and they talk about Office apps, and of course one of the things that continue to say.
Hey, just for the people who haven't read the article or are unaware of what the consortium is all about, the recent backlash of the Desktop Linux Summit, which was this past week, was it not?
Mm-hmm. In San Diego.
Yes, and
it's this next week.
Is it next week?
It's on the 21st and 22nd.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm in a time warp, I guess. Anyways, there was a little bit of concern over the situation involved with that, and so a few people who were originally participants in that event got together with Bruce Perens, guys from CodeWeavers, guys from Lacorus, a couple other Linux companies, got together, hashed out the basic concept of a vendor-neutral consortium of what the summit was originally intended to be, put it together, and then immediately turned around, and first thing they did, as they were putting together the committee that was putting it together, first thing they did then was to turn around and invite Lindos to join, to express to them that what happened in the past is the past, and we're going to move on in peace and hopefully prosperity for all involved. So it's a really great, great idea.
Well, it's something that needed to be done.
It should have been done before the event was even started.
Well, what's interesting about this is that the press we've been having for the last, what has it been, about 6 months, maybe a little about 9 months, where we've seen a lot of press coming on about Linux on the desktop, Linux on the desktop. It started about last summer, maybe, where we started seeing, you know, an article here and there about it, and then this thing seems to be catching on a little bit. And of course, the standard caveat, and I must say, in computer world here, they hit this drum a little bit, and is that, well, it doesn't run on Windows Office yet, you know. Well, you know, excuse me, we got our own Office. But you know, basically, even that drum is being silenced a bit, because real people realize that Open Office is a real thing. And it's getting praised, quite widespread praise for that.
I want to jump in here because I haven't had much to say on this so far, but I have had a lot of conversations with people at Lindos, people with Bruce, with a bunch of other people who are kind of caught in the middle on this Desktop Linux Summit thing. And I put it, one of the most widely read items that we've had on Linux Journal in a long time was a piece. It's now scrolled off the middle of the front page. It's still on the front page in smaller print on the right side. It's called Crossing the Desktop Linux Chasm in San Diego. Really interesting to look at at really sort of like two completely different cultures going on here that need to meet and probably will in the long run, I think. It was really interesting. I can't begin to go into all of the detail in it, except that a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of people talking past each other, a lot of, you know, assumptions made.
A classic Clue Train example.
Yeah, and about 8 levels. And I just wrote the May editorial for Linux Journal. It's like, I'm all full of it, but I can't, it's not up yet, it won't be up for 3 months. But I was rereading Jeffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm. Very, very interesting book. I mean, these are Crossing the Chasm and Inside the Tornado are like major marketing books in the mid-90s that talk about the difference between early adopters and early majority, and how you've got one culture on one side and one culture on the other. The interesting thing to me, though, is that Linux has always appealed to the early majority cultural set of interests, you know, practicality, low price, standards, yada yada. You know, it's just a really interesting thing to read. Just an interesting sort of template to kind of press down on top of this stuff. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw in that 4 cents worth of whatever.
Next article from CNET News. This is really good news. Let's see, who's Gartner Data Quest? Well, good old Gartner. Well, in this case, they seem to be doing something in Linux's favor. Total Linux server revenue was $384 million in the fourth quarter, up 90% from $202 million. That's pretty good, especially considering the reporting that U.S. server revenue climbed just 5% in the fourth quarter, compared with a year earlier. So an increase of 90% just on 5% increase overall is pretty good. And they're reporting IBM was the chief beneficiary of that. And they're also reporting that IBM is probably one of the companies that has helped spurn this. IBM shipping Blade servers, 75% of which run Linux. Good article on CNET News. On that.
Yeah, the only thing that isn't clear in the article And I saw this article as well, and I emailed the author, Ian Fried, or however you pronounce his name. I'm not sure whether the information that's in the first sentence is totally clear. It says up 90% from 202 million. Does he mean up from 202 million the year previous or the quarter previous? I don't really know.
Yeah, well, that's true. It looks like that he means the quarter previous, but then the next sentence he talks about the year earlier, so I don't know.
It's a little confusing, but still, regardless.
Either way, it's good news.
Yeah, regardless, either way, it's good news. And
there is another article from California here. This is also reported by CNET News. A lawsuit challenges software licensing. A California woman is suing Microsoft, Symantec, and some other software retailers, claiming companies concocted a scheme to mislead consumers by requiring them to consent to software license agreements they haven't read. Well, we all know this scam, the shrink wrap license, where you you don't get to read the license till you open the software, and when you open the software, surprise! Here comes the, you know, you cannot reverse engineer, you cannot test, you cannot report tests, you know, benchmark tests. And this has gotten some, apparently this has gotten some good play in a judge in New York ruled last month that network associates could not enforce wording that prohibited reviews of its product without prior consent. And that's good to see that this kind of thing is coming to the courts, because that needs to go to the courts.
Speaking of software licenses, guess who's back?
Who?
Okay.
The Business Software Alliance.
Oh.
They are once again making a major charge, speaking of licensing. There's two commercials running in the major markets around the United States. One of them is an educational piece, and I use that in quotes, educational, a threat. One that's an educational piece for business owners, and one that's an educational piece for employees. The one that's for the businesses, I suppose, is fine, taking into consideration they do have a closed source licensed product that's totally legal. And so it's within their rights to inform people that they should observe their licenses if they agreed to them. But the commercial that they're using for educating the employees of companies is despicable. It starts out with, "Do you hate your boss?" Isn't that just get ya? That's how it starts out. Do you hate your boss?
Are they suggesting that a person hating his boss might use...
No, basically what the commercial is how you go about getting information on how to spy on your boss and turn him in. And collect fines, or collect fees for the fines. So, again, these are playing in the major markets across the United States right now. Listen for them. They just said
playing where? On the radio? On the TV?
On the radio.
On the radio, oh, okay.
Okay, listen for them. They've been playing in the Chicago market since last weekend.
Jeepers.
So,
oh, my goodness.
They're back.
Hey, Jeff.
Well, that one's going to really...
I think somebody chimed in. Yes?
Yeah, this is Chris DeBona.
Hi, Chris.
If you guys,
hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. I don't know if you guys covered the hate, not the hate mail, but the mail they sent off... late last year, they sent off a mass mailing to basically every business in the Silicon Valley and
yep.
South Bay and the Bay Area, saying, you should do this or we'll audit you, and it was kind of creepy, actually.
I've seen that one. That was pretty bad.
Yeah, we got that at VA when I was still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very scary. It's very Gestapo-like tactics, and, yeah, they're back. So everybody keep an eye out. Arnie, I know you got some more, but...
I do have two real short ones.
I want to spread it around, Arnie. It's already 8.
Okay, that's right.
We'll come back to you if you got more. Russ, your hot stories of the week.
Yeah, actually, Arnie touched on most of them, but let me just amplify one or two points and add one story. The thing that got me, Doc, when Doc did that that great article on the desktop summit that Arnie mentioned. The thing that got me about that...
Keep up your volume, Russ, please.
It's dropping off still?
Yep.
Well, I got it on full boost now. Let's see how that goes. The thing that got me about that is the way in which everything seemed to be deemed as silly by the Lindos representative, and that to me, Lindos aside, that to me is one of the things that I think we need to fight as open source becomes more popular in business. There is this undercurrent notion that the things that the community does, and also I noted that the community was in quotes almost all the time, the things that the community does is somehow silly, and these disputes are somehow fruitless. The people inside traditional business world can sometimes think that's the case, but unfortunately it's not. It's not at all. I mean, this has to do with the lifeblood of the community itself. And when you're working in a cooperative situation, you have to be able to sit down and negotiate. You have to be able to sit down and decide common ground rules. So I think this is something that kind of got highlighted by this, but it's something I think we all need to be aware of, especially when we're dealing with businesses that are just coming into the open source world, somehow educating to the notion that when you're in a cooperative situation like this, you really do have to take regard of what others out there are thinking, because you're relying on their efforts, and you know, just don't go around screwing over your business partners.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. Ironically, I got a letter this past week from Microsoft, and there's a letter from Chris Mayo. And he was inviting me to participate in an event to explain what the news about .NET really means to the entire computing world. Now, there's everybody's aware, there's been a lot of news coming out about the .NET patents and how they may be executed, and whether or not we can trust Microsoft and what they're doing. But all that aside, what you're saying, Russ, about people needing to really take a very, very deep understanding of the way a community behaves is very, very important. Microsoft has even come to the realization, and that's part of the reason why they sent this letter out, is they've come to the realization that they have made a dramatic mistake ignoring their own communities. And the irony on all this is all of a sudden I'm seeing new kinds of titles coming out of Microsoft. And I want everybody to watch for this over the course of the next month or two. But the new title that Chris DeMaio has is no longer a manager of .NET development. He is now .NET community evangelist.
Hmm.
Okay? And so they even understand what you're saying, Russ.
Well, they're using the titles anyway, but I don't for a minute think that Microsoft has the mindset as a corporation to pull off anything other than use the titles. It's like putting a tag on the thing to make it seem that way.
I've got to disagree with you because they've developed an incredibly large community of Microsoft's MCSEs, the Microsoft engineers. So,
yeah.
Arnie, you're wrong.
Well, but it's just they're not going to open the source.
Well, it's got nothing to do with opening the source. All Russ was talking about is interacting with community and understanding the needs of your community and understanding the needs of how to communicate with that community. And Microsoft is showing some surprising awareness to that fact, I think.
I'm getting similar vibes. A few months ago, you know, I was invited to speak there. You know, and it's funny, somebody sent me, somebody from Israel sent me a link to a blog from Boston that, you know, that talked about how Microsoft was doing 10 things wrong, and one of them was they make everybody go through NDAs, they make them do this and that and the other thing. And, of course, I've only been there one time, but it was not my experience there. You know, my experience there was that there are, at least down in the rank and file, some people who are curious and interested in finding out what's going on in the rest of the world. Maybe at core it's still evil. I don't know, but it's not as monolithic as it appears.
Well, and no company is ever.
Yeah.
And there's probably a lot of Linux being run at Microsoft.
Oh, there is, for sure. Absolutely. In fact, one of the things I've been hearing repeatedly lately, and this is a very interesting thing, is that, maybe it's not a bad time to jump in, but I invite readers to write to me about this. I mean, not readers, but listeners to write to me about this, too. I'm very interested in seeing what's happening inside big companies that isn't being reported by anybody about quiet Linux adoption. It's going on everywhere. I mean, I'm getting emails almost every day from people at Fortune 50 companies about things going past the skunk work stage, you know, to where it's turning into policy. You know, there are big ground movements going on right now.
Absolutely, and that's
around
right.
Linux. And Microsoft is all over that. I mean, they know it. You know, it's like, you know, wait a minute, you know, the gig is, it may not be up yet, but what Linux is doing is it's replacing it's real infrastructure, and Windows is not real infrastructure, and the difference is becoming really, really obvious to these big companies. And it's not like Exchange servers going away tomorrow by a long shot, but it's going to be running on Linux in 3 or 4 years at the most. It's inevitable that this is going to happen.
If they want to stay in business.
If they want to stay in business, and, you know, they don't have any trouble making Mac software, they're going to have no trouble making Linux software. It's a matter of time.
Yeah.
Absolutely a matter of time.
Yeah. And they will probably make, my guess, is pretty good Linux software. They'll probably do well making Linux software.
Yeah, and they'll make it cross, and they'll make it, you know, they'll finally make the file formats compatible across, you know, three platforms instead of two. Because they want to operate in the third world, and Linux is getting huge in the third world. You know, they can't fight that. It's just a matter of time. So that's the take. That's sort of like just in the last few days, this has sort of become a real clear thing to me.
Well, you know, I'd like to actually comment on that if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, no, go for it.
I think a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that Linux is competing.
You need to speak up just a touch.
Sure. They think that Linux is competing against Windows as a financial thing, and that's true for large companies and medium-sized companies, but for the third world, they couldn't care less about price. Whether it's Windows or Linux or anything, because everything is free for them. They just pirate what they want.
Right.
Right? So the place that Linux wins, I think this is true in the United States as well, is where it's actually better, right? So the question then becomes, when does the Linux desktop become so much better? You know what I mean? For just the generic people who are picking up software anywhere, right? So, and it, for me, that's why you see Linux in places like Apache and DNS and mail, because it's so clearly better and so much easier to run, right?
Apache is very easy to run.
Part of it's less hassle, you know? That's a big part of it. It's just less hassle.
Who wants to deal with that other stuff, you know?
It's funny thing is I really don't see China, for instance, country like China, you know, which Linux, I mean, which Microsoft is courting quite heavily. I don't see China bowing to Microsoft because I can't see China using Windows in their government infrastructure without having the source code. I just can't see it. I just can't see them doing it.
China's a done deal. That one's over.
Yeah, that one's way over.
Dak or Russ, do you guys have any additional stories?
Yeah, I do, but let me chime in real quick on this too. I don't disagree with what Doc was saying, except for one basic thing, and that is that if the management of Microsoft right now was second generation, then I would agree with him. that Microsoft software on Linux is inevitable, but it's not. It's still having the same entrepreneurs leading the organization, and that means that they have to write off Windows to make that step. They have to come to the point in their mind where they're going to say, well, Windows is not going to be the dominant desktop operating system anymore. And historically, at least, most entrepreneurs can't hop that, or at least not in time.
I should qualify what I'm saying is that the people I'm hearing from is not a desktop issue, it's all server stuff.
Okay, because quite frankly, you know, I think the biggest hurdle here is not technology. It's not any number of things. When it comes down to it, at this point, the question for me is: will the egos involved be able to back away from their baby?
Yep.
I frankly don't see it in the short term.
I agree with the thought about the egos. But I'm really not sure if this is going to play out the way you think in the case of a company like Microsoft. Because let's look at Microsoft's history. They have actually been in the business of periodically, every 3 or 4 or 5 years, writing off their product.
Except for Office and Windows, because they're the only two that make money, according to the SEC filing.
Yeah, they wrote off OS 2 pretty well.
They wrote off Phoenix, they wrote off DOS.
But these are the only two that are cash cows that they have left.
Short term, okay, but DOS was a cash cow too.
Yeah, but it was planted.
They forced the market to move.
They have never had a whole lot of trouble killing off anything that's terminal. Now, Windows is a huge franchise for them, but I think I don't think this is just like a binary choice. I mean, I think that they've got a lot of life left on that on the desktop.
Oh, I would agree with you, but there is an emotional issue first, and that is they have to come to the notion that it will no longer be the dominant bear. That's the decision that has to be made before you start seeing, you know, MS Office for Linux or other equivalent things. They have to make that decision, whereas with Apple, they don't.
Right.
Because with Apple, they say it's a niche market. We probably aren't going to own the market, so let's just get what we can out of it.
And be as best as we can.
And we'll get our profit.
Yeah, actually, I think what they said there is it's a niche market. We can have that one, too, which they do with Office. It's an interesting. I mean, I don't think that this is something that happens overnight or that it happens across the board. I think it's a huge board, and there's just lots of conditionalities involved. But I think that if you read Clayton Christensen's Innovator's Dilemma, it's very interesting. You know, because they describe themselves as an innovative company, and innovative companies make small incremental improvements to the proven stuff that mass quantities of customers continue to want, and they get blindsided by something that's slowly been adopted and suddenly does better. I think that they're smart enough not to get too blindsided by that, but they are what they are, which is a big industrial company that's very vested in what they've been doing for a long time.
Well, I think you're right, Doc, and I think the XP license is a, how should we put this, a legal workaround to address that issue.
Yeah.
Definitely so. I'd like to throw out a couple of stories to the group and get you to put in your 2 cents about a couple of items. First one is there have been a number of stories that have popped up over the last couple of days that I believe pretty much all stem from a story written by Tina Gasparon at NewsForge a few days ago about the ire of people in the Linux community or people in the open source community, however you want to identify it, being mad because Microsoft is appearing at expos and
advertising on the Linux sites.
And advertising on the Linux sites. And I mean, if you read some of the postings and some of the articles that have followed up on this theme, people are really incredibly upset on this, and I'm sitting there going, well, what's the big deal? Who cares? I mean, you know, their company, you know, if they pay their 25 cents for the admission to the expo, they have as much right as anybody else to exhibit their products. It's not illegal.
But there's more to it, though, Jeff, because this thing here has to do with the fact that they're speaking. And the Tina's article, particularly, is that they are speaking at the Open Source for National and Local E-Government Programs.
I still say, so what?
Yeah, well, that becomes the issue. Now,
okay.
The issue is, as they are not part of the open source world, arguably, should they be given that... that much leverage, and
okay.
You know, it comes down to, you know, will Microsoft speak at a Sun conference? Will Oracle speak at a Microsoft conference? You know, by and large, these things don't happen.
If Microsoft is invited to appear, and you don't just speak at conferences unless you're invited, why shouldn't they?
Oh, I agree with it there. I guess the question becomes, should they be invited inside that sense? And I've seen some interesting things both ways. The thing that actually disturbs me about all of this is that I see some feedback, like at the NewsForge article, where people are saying, well, when they take the podium, they should be shouted down. And that is the absolute worst concept I can think of.
You see, my perspective on this is, you invite Microsoft to open source conference and let them try to defend their version of their open license scheme for governments and such, and I think it very clearly highlights the difference between what Microsoft is doing and what the majority of other people are doing with open source developments, and I think this is good information to people to have. I don't think it should be hidden.
Yeah, it's interesting because there was a conference over in Jordan a few months ago, and I was talking with a few of the people who were there, and they said that it was supposed to be an largely open source conference, but Microsoft was there and they were presenting. And they apparently had gone to the organizers and had the organizers go to the open source speakers and to make sure that they did not defame Microsoft in any way, that they didn't speak against Microsoft. And that was made clear to them. And so, from what I understand, the open source speakers didn't go around doing Microsoft bashing. But when the Microsoft people got their chance, they spent apparently a fair amount of time open source bashing. But the interesting thing there was that the take on it from the people that I talked to was that the attendees could see that there was something wrong. And in particular, that if a company is going out of their way to bash open source, then maybe they've got an attitude problem, basically. So it actually worked against Microsoft to deal with things that way.
Exactly my point.
Yeah.
I mean,
Microsoft have an attitude problem? No! I'm shocked.
But you know, it is interesting. The question that some people raise of, well, what, should they be there in the first place is interesting. But I really have a problem with some of the proposed solutions that some people have.
I think they're a potential disaster.
Absolutely, because, you know, thinking of it from a business standpoint, most, at least American businessmen, stay away from things that have too much to do with either religion, inside the technical sense, or things that are highly controversial. And if you have a group of open source people who are out there shouting down Microsoft or anyone else that whose name they know, that's going to tell them over and over again that you don't want anything to do with these people. And that's not the place where we need to be, quite frankly. So, I mean, if they're there, they're there. But I think it's, you know, it's worth debating whether or not they should be there one way or the other.
Well, I mean, if I think if they get in, they get involved in these shows and they start trying to defame open source or trying to, you know, use the FUD channel, I think they know that the FUD hasn't worked over the years, and they're just going to stab themselves in the foot. And look at, they come to our forum, and we don't, you know, our forums, and the community doesn't ask them to not defame Linux or open source. They're free to say what they want.
Well, again, whose fault is that, Arnie? Is that
I mean,
right?
You know, I mean, I think that's the way we operate, is that we operate as a free, open community, and if you want to, listen, if you don't like something about Linux, you can say it.
Yeah, but is it Microsoft's fault, or is it the guys who ran that conference fault for telling the other people to not defame Microsoft?
Oh, okay.
Whose
well.
Fault is it? It's certainly not Microsoft.
Yeah.
Just because they say something doesn't mean you have to obey.
That's true.
Okay?
I think it should be a level playing field.
No. Somewhat. Okay, we got a couple more stories that I'd like to sneak in before we take the break. In particular, there is one link that Arnie, you sent in the clueless pundit category.
Yeah.
Let's throw that one up and say, let's save the rest of the stories for next week. But go ahead, Arnie, chime in on that one, because that article really is inept. I mean, it really, it's funny. It's funny.
It's, yeah. It's according inept. To this guy at Network News, and I believe this is UK. I believe it's UK. The link is up on the page, Linux Show. Comment, Linux causes long card game. This guy's name is Roger Howarth, IT Week. And this was published 2/10/2003. So it's a brand new article. And he claims that you cannot put two network interface cards on Linux, on 2.2 Linux kernel. And, of course, I've been running two network cards on Linux for forever. And I think I was doing it on the 2.0 Linux kernel. Of course, it's always been available. And this guy is obviously just one dumb shit. Because he, I mean, anybody who knows anything about network administrating and configuring a network, a Linux machine, knows that you can put as many network interface cards as you want. All you have to do is load the module. And loading two modules the same is just as easy. It's all over the internet how to do it. I mean, it's like, this is so simple. It's in the how-to. Mr. Howarth, read the how-to. Read, you'll find it there. And you know what? This guy is all over the internet with this article. And you know, this is just a shameless, I just can't figure it out. What words are coming from?
It's ineptitude. That's all. It's
just totally ineptitude. This guy doesn't deserve to have a job writing about IT when he's saying this kind of patent rubbish.
I don't even know if it's right to call it rubbish. It's just, it's ineptitude. The guy has
guy's
no
clueless.
Knowledge.
We need someone to get the clue bat out and take a big hefty swing. There's one. I got an email on that just before showtime from one of our listeners, and he sent a letter which I'll be forwarding to Mr. Howarth, and this letter is the equivalent of a clue bat.
Well, let's save the rest of the remaining stories for next week's show. This is the third week in a row I bumped the work spot story. We'll get to it eventually. But anyway, so let's take a break, come back with segment number two, and Chris DeBona. Chris, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, well, everybody hang in there for about 3 or 4 minutes. We'll take a short break. This is The Linux Show. We'll be right back.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make The Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms.
He put all of his soul into a tenor saxophone. He had his way of talking, 'twas a language on his own. Life's story, love and glory, if you listen, when it plays it for you, now listen and listen and dig it. Can't you dig it? Lester Young is playing what he's feeling. Dealing and dancing. Now someone might have told you Lester Young is out of style. But now I'm here to tell you press is happening.
We're back.
This is the Linux Show for Tuesday, the 11th of February, 2003. We're bringing you segment number two. Our guest tonight is an old friend of the Linux Show, Chris DeBona. He's been on many, many, many times in previous lives as one responsibility or another over at the VA company. Chris has recently left to put together a new company that is on the verge of releasing a, I shouldn't say on the verge of releasing, but is in the process of developing new technology for a future product release of some rather significant gaming technology. So, Chris, welcome back to the Linux Show.
Thanks.
And good to hear you back. Before we get into talking about the company and the new product and all the fun stuff, I'd really like to just real quick catch up on one thing, because I know a lot of people have been emailing me and asking me to put this question to you in terms of how things are going at the old company. Do they appear to be stable over at VA?
So I actually, for the last year or so as at VA, worked on the OSDN side of things. And so I know a lot more about what they're doing. So from what I can say about that, they're doing pretty great. So OSDN, which consists of Slashdot, Fresh Meat, SourceForge, all the public face of the media, that people are used to. Those are doing really well, As far as the SourceForge business goes for VA, I really wasn't involved with that so much. What they're trying to do is, I guess they're going to trying to bring out version 4 right now. So I can't help out too much with VA, but I know that OSDN is doing well.
Well, that's good.
And there's really, I've actually still got a contract back with Slashdot, so I'm still editing on Slashdot, so that's still going great.
Well, that's good. I hope to hang on and continue to make forward steps. A lot of friends over there, just wish them all the best. Don't want to see anybody get hurt. So tell us about the new gig. And again, I got to remind you, please talk loud. We've got a real low gain on your phone connection. So tell us about the new company and why you decided to do it.
Well, actually, it's interesting. People who listen to the Linux Show will actually know one of my co-founders, Tony Gunthorpe. He was the guy who started SourceForge at VA. And Tony and I were at Linux World in August here in San Francisco last year. And we were just talking about what we wanted to do. Because, I've sort of had my eye out for something new to do. Because I've been at VA or OSDN in some form or another for almost 4 years. And I was getting kind of antsy, right? So, I obviously love this kind of game. And so did he. And we always talked about, ways we would make a really fun, cool game. And we finally said, well, why don't we just do that, right? So we, picked up some office space. I left VA in early October, and that's where I'm calling you from on a phone I've never done radio on before, so sorry about that. So that's what we did. And so the game itself is Reconstruction. It's set in the future about 400 years, and it's actually sort of an Earth simulator with a really good backstory, right? We're actually taking models of the Earth using satellite data to model it, and to have that be the playing surface for a large, massively multiplayer online game. So the idea being that, I don't know how much you know about online games, but a lot of them, even the largest, they don't allow a lot of people to play at any one time on the same server. So they have, like, multiple servers. For instance, EverQuest, they've got 32 servers, none of which interact with each other, right? So you can have, say, 3,000 or 4,000 players on each server set, and you can't move around between them. So it ends up actually really breaking up the continuity if you want to have a friend be on that server. You just can't sometimes. And it's a real problem in my mind. So, and it was a problem for all of us. So we wanted to make a game where that wasn't a limitation. So that's kind of where we're going right now.
So the Reconstruction back end then is specifically designed to allow the scalability.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, Tony and I before VA, and even while we were at VA, we helped out with stuff like this. But, you know, our background is extremely large systems. You know, I used to work for Tandem. You know, we saw the problems that the games are having with these limitation problems. And we see this as an architectural and sort of a philosophy problem in how you design the game, right? So we're trying to bring sort of a large systems philosophy and an understanding of those kinds of requirements to the gaming space, you know, and to make a much better game possible because of that, right? So, and we also have, you know, the added benefit that other people have already started in the space, and so we've seen the kind of problems they've run into, right? So that's part of why we wanted to do this, is to show it could be done, and it could be done in such a way that's fun and playable and profitable, right? So.
Now, what sort of platforms are you working towards running this on? I'm presuming you're writing it right now for Intel boxes, but if you're talking about that level of scalability, what do you have in mind?
Oh, well, the back end is going to be running Linux, and that's going to be initially probably a cluster of Intel boxes with Gig Ethernet until we get to certain scalability levels, and then we'll have to either switch to mainframes running Linux or basically have a good hard look at our interconnect technology and how we can deal with that. You know, the database technology will likely be either DB2 or Oracle running on a mainframe. So, yeah. It's mostly, it's a matter of throughput, right? Because I don't know how deep you want to get into sort of the theory of how you make these games, but you have these interest relationships between players. Like if player A is talking to or fighting with or looking at player B.
Right.
And they're not exactly on the same server, then these servers need to talk to each other and share state, right? And share all kinds of state all the time about all these players. So you end up actually hitting significant limits, not just at the network layer, but also at the PCI layer, as you get to having too many players on any one server, right? And you actually have a problem with inter-server communication at some point. So we have ways we want to deal with this, and that's actually part of, you know, what we're selling in a way. I mean, we're selling a game, but what we're really selling is sort of this great architecture in the back end. And we actually plan on commoditizing that and selling that as a service later on.
You call it a mega mud.
Well, I mean, you know, the spiritual ancestors of these games are the muds and the moos, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
That's a nice. I like that. I mean, it's got a nice ring to it. Mega mud.
Mega mud. My last one. So, was that from the chat or something?
Yeah. I don't know.
So it really is the long term then, really, selling reconstruction, or is the long term selling the back end to Sierra?
Well, not to Sierra. They're not really around anymore. No, the long-term business of Damage Studios and Damage Software is selling games like Reconstruction and selling an engine with sort of a variety of services going from just a straight graphics engine for single-player games all the way to, you know, basically letting people, you know, either buy or rent our services to build these kinds of games, you know? There's a lot of things right now. All we're really concentrating on right now is Reconstruction, right? Because we need to be focused, right? But, you know, we also have sort of a side business in simulation for governments and that kind of thing that we're looking at. But right now, you know, the real money for us is Reconstruction.
Ah, Lawrence Livermore Laboratories will probably want to talk to you.
Well, actually, you know, Lawrence, it's not so much simulation in terms of mathematical simulations. I mean, I know the math is the base of all this stuff, right? But more like actually joint operation simulations. Like instead of having France and Europe and, well, it's not that France is a part of Europe, but, you know, our different partners all over the world, if we want to do a joint exercise, it's very costly in terms of material and human life sometimes, right? This is a way that people can sort of practice together.
But you're modeling political systems too.
Yeah, we have a political engine in it.
And that's what's interesting, and that's what makes the idea kind of a compelling idea. Because if you're going to be doing all that, and you're going to be doing political systems too, this is like a really good boon for playing what if at the global level.
Well, and the thing is also, you know, that's really hard to do if you only have 3,000 people on a server. I really think that you don't really get any sort of accurate picture of what civilizations move around like or do until you hit a certain number, and I think that number is somewhere in the 100 to 200,000 range. So, yeah, now I've thought a lot about the government simulation angle of it, and it's in just the straight political simulation that this game will represent, right? So it's pretty interesting. And it's another reason why we did this, because it's a very interesting problem.
Sounds like a fairly good research project, too.
Well, yeah.
Very interesting.
How many people are actually working on the coding?
Well, right now we're still very small. We only have 8 employees, right? So we've got 2 people who are working full-time on the code, and then we've got 3 art people, Tony and myself, and a marketing person. So we're working pretty hard right now, mostly on preparing the prototype and getting more investment, right, so we can get to where we need to get to. So.
Hmm.
There's a question out on IRC that says, is most of the load-bearing simulation done on the server or the client?
Well, there's no real problem with cheating in a simulation, in a load-bearing simulation, right? Because it's all here in the office, right? But the load-bearing simulations that we really want to do, they're done both on the server and the client, right? The real problem, actually, with these games and the clients is, how do you stop cheating, right? It's sort of an arms race over time between the companies who produce these games and the people who play them, right? And it's sort of like, in a way, dealing with the troll problem on Slashdot, right? There's some people, once they get bored with the game, they decide they sort of want to, you know, pee all over it, to use a horrible phrase. And so the nice thing about the game versus something like Slashdot is we don't have the anonymity problem that Slashdot has. You know, we know who's doing things. Right, so we can boot them, right? So it's more like, it's actually a much easier problem from that perspective. I don't know if I'm really answering that person's question, though.
Well,
it was a good answer, whether you did or you didn't.
Well, you know, it's something we think a lot about, because, you know, we know that, you know, the second we open up the beta to people outside the world, that's when the war begins, right? And it's like, because, you know, we want to preserve the game for those who are looking to play the game, and not for those who are looking to ruin it, right? So it's really kind of hard, right? But that's okay. We're up for that. We know what we're getting into. Because, so, you know, a lot of people, you know, they look at these games and they have this picture in their mind of what it's going to be. And when it changes, because it always will when people play them, they don't know what to do, you know? And you saw this with Sony and EverQuest when people started selling things on eBay. You know, items, characters, the whole thing. So what they did is they, you know, brought up the lawyers and they said, well, we're not going to allow this, da, 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 da. And what they really needed to do to make it palatable to themselves is either make money off it by setting up an escrow service or something, or at least making the transactions escrowed on their servers, right, so that they wouldn't have a problem, right? Because the problem they had is that people were ripping each other off, and they were getting pissed at Sony, right? Anyway, I don't want to go too far on that. But it's like people generally change anything they interact with, and you just have to be ready for that. And I think that we're good for that.
Well, that's human nature.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we like to modify our environment so that it favors us, and we win. So you got to be prepared for that.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris, a question. You had said that you don't think that a simulation really gets going on a worldwide scale until, I think you said, until you get like 100,000 or 200,000 players.
That's my opinion.
And, you know, I'm wondering, do you really think that, you know, given the fact that we're, you know, almost 2 years away from your expected release, do you think that you're going to be able to get that number of players at that point in time?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's actually, doing games is really cool because, you know, it's not like we're trying to come out with an office productivity application, right? You know, people are always willing to try a new game. You know, they're always willing to sort of give a new game a chance. You know, as long as people haven't told them that it's terrible, right? Excuse me. So what you see is that when a game like this comes out, a lot of sort of the early adopter types will get into the beta period, and then they'll go around and they'll tell people what they thought. And if they liked it, then the people who will sort of who follow the Blues News and the other kinds of sites, they'll say, okay, well, then I'll try it out when it comes out, right? So that's where you are. And so it's not like one of the things where, you know, there are so many people, you know, in the space and then nobody else can come in, right?
Okay. From IRC, there's a question about how about the bandwidth requirements coming into the server room for 100,000 players?
Well, you know, in a way we're sort of used to that, too. I mean, SourceForge takes up, what, 60 megabits per second right now? The bandwidth actually isn't a problem. We know how to deal with bandwidth problems. We'll co-locate in a number of different places. You know, somebody just mentioned online, what about basically the home, right, to play the game? And we are requiring broadband, just so KD50B knows that. But, yeah, no, so for the servers, what's more important is actually the latency between the far-flung servers in other countries and even between coasts in the United States to make sure that people have a good game experience, right? Because we don't have a problem provisioning bandwidth. You know, bandwidth is easy. There's so much dark fiber out there right now. It's a buyer's market, right? And it will be for years and years to come. So that's not an issue, really.
You might have more trouble getting IP addresses before IPv6.
That's a fact. Well, it's a tractable problem, but it's a problem, right? So.
Yeah.
Of course, if you have a great big pipe, you can do one IP address, and that's enough.
So eventually, you're going to have this Z-Series IBM supercomputer, right?
That'd be nice. And in fact, if IBM is listening, they can just send one right to our office. We'll take care of it.
Well, I have a question on the other end, then. You know, if you're planning on ramping up to, you know, some mammoth piece of hardware to run the simulation, at what point in time do you start to turn down the service? I mean, after a couple of years, most games tend to fizzle. And would you then downgrade the server at that point, or do you pull the plug? I mean, what do you do from a service aspect in this?
Well, okay, so I'll answer your question, but let me answer it first with sort of painting a picture of what the market looks like for these kinds of games. Ultima Online, which a lot of people sort of consider the first major game like this, still has 230,000 people subscribed to it paying $10 a month.
Wow.
So they're not going to be shutting that down as long as people are on it.
Right.
I mean, so then the real question becomes, well, what's the cutoff point, right, when it doesn't become worth doing anymore from a profitability standpoint? Well, the nice thing about mainframes, as you might know, is with IBM, you can actually shut off capability as much as you can turn it on. You know, they'll ship you a box that's completely stacked, and you'll only have bought, you know, two processors or four processors and X, you know, gigabytes of memory or whatever, right? So you can actually go the other direction and say, well, we don't need, you know, all 64 processors anymore. We only need 32. And more realistically, as time goes on, you know, the hardware gets more capable, right? It gets faster. So as you're moving along, you end up needing less hardware. So it's kind of cool that way. I mean, Moore's Law really works for games in that way. So then it really just becomes an accounting question. You know, how many people do we need minimum to keep the game going, right, and to pay for the people who are continually adding features and art to the game, right? So.
Well, in my opinion, in 2 or 3 years, one of you guys will log into the network, and it'll respond with "Welcome to World Control," and it shades of the Forbin Project.
Yeah, no, that was a fun thing. I don't know if you remember during the '80s how many BBSs had the name the Forbin Project, but
yeah, the Colossus, the Forbin Project.
Yeah,
all '60s science fiction, pretty good actually.
It was okay, but really. Taking the consideration, there goes Doc, taking the consideration that some of the games that have either totally open-sourced or partially open-sourced their games so that the people who are participating within that community, those games, I mean, Quake is probably the biggest example of this, have had unbelievably long runs as compared with your traditional closed-source video game. So I don't necessarily think you are faced with a two-year obsolescence cycle if you give people the keys. And, you know, if you're predicting they're going to modify their universe, you let them modify their universe, and that adds life to the game overall.
Well, that would be true if that's the kind of game we were selling. What we're actually selling them is this world, right? And
right.
The capability to bring a ton of people together in one world and one sort of narrative flow. So, you know, sure, people are going to probably do the BattleNet thing and try to simulate the services, the servers, and then try to plug their clients against that and whatever. But what we're selling is this monthly service. You know, this world, in essence. We're renting them a world to plug into.
Yeah.
As long as we do that well, you know, we really don't care what happens, you know, somebody creating another server. Now, the thing is, we won't be open sourcing the client. And the reason is because of that war mentality we talked about earlier. It's just, for a first-person shooter even, you know, you saw this problem with Quake and with people putting in the modifications, you know, the aiming modifications and the other bits. So, yeah. So, no, we won't be open sourcing the client.
Another question from IRC. Will the creative players who add value to the whole game in general be rewarded?
Well, the flip answer is they'll be rewarded by playing the game, by having a game to be creative in. You know, the non-flip answer is that people who don't feel rewarded through their gameplay will leave. You know, so they will be rewarded. It won't be financial, because there's significant problems with that. Because how do you value what people are doing, right? It's like if somebody builds like some great building, are they more valuable or less valuable than somebody who is running a great guild, right? So you have to ask yourself, how do you reward people? You know, what's the carrot that they're getting for all this stuff they do online? You know, and then you get to a sort of a more fundamental question of why do people play games, right? And you sort of have to answer that to have a successful game.
Maybe allow them to sell like their role on eBay.
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely. They can sell their characters. They can sell their items. We don't care about that. We won't be selling items. We'll have to find them in the world and build them in the world. But we're not talking about, you know, we're not going to keep people from selling things on eBay or whatever. In fact, what we'll have is we'll have an escrow system so that they can check something into the escrow system so that the people who are bidding on what they're selling can make sure that they actually exist.
The question was phrased by David in New Zealand, and he, regular contributor to the Linux Show, and he clarifies it and says, "I'm talking about adding new modules, objects, artwork, codes, etc."
Models and thus objects, yes. No code and artwork. We have to be very, very careful because we want to be a global game. So, what happens when somebody creates a building and slaps a swastika on the side of it, right? In the United States, this is completely legal, right? In Europe, it's not, you know. What if somebody puts up a copy of Scientology's text on the side of a building as their texture, right? In the United States, we would immediately get a DMCA takedown notice, right? Which, and I don't think the DMCA will be repealed before we do this, and so we'll have to pay attention to a judge, right? So how do we deal with that problem is actually a big deal. So, you know, how we're going to handle people uploading textures, it means we have to have a human being looking at them. And so that really slows down how fast we can bring them in.
Moderation, right?
What's that?
You mean like moderation?
Well, it's more like abuse control, right? Because if we want to, for instance, market this game in a place like China, you know, and you have some guy walking around trying to drum up support for Falun Gong in China, we have to respond to that if we want to be in China, right? So it's like you have all kinds of really strange problems when you go international. So.
Yeah, an enforcement nightmare.
Well, what we really want to do for the global stuff is actually bring in partners in these countries, in China, in Japan, in Korea, in Germany, in France, who understand those cultures and can do them right. So,
other question is, will there be a Linux client from the start? And another question out there is, do you expect that the new proposed California Internet download tax will cause you problems in this area?
Well, the tax, the California tax, is more of a question that I need to pass on to my lawyers because I don't know. I don't know how that matters. You know, because is the Internet tax that California is proposing cover services, you know, which is sort of what we're selling. Now, when we sell a boxed piece of software, well, we know how to handle that, right? And we ship something out before they start playing. The question is, what happens, you know, when people download things, and what does it mean to download something, right? So I mean, there are some really sort of interesting problems there. and I don't know how to answer this. As far as like a Linux client, probably from the first, you know, Windows is our main platform because that's where the installed base is. After that, you know, the Mac and Linux get some attention. Now, what's great about Linux is, and a lot of people hate to hear this, but it's, excuse me, is Transvirtual's software. I have no reason to doubt that it'll work in a Transvirtual with no problem. So, you know, people who are hardcore gamers and will only game under Linux already have that. So, you know, unfortunately, the reality is for buying an engine with Linux is you have to pay per platform. So that means we would need to know that enough people would buy the software for specifically a platform before we could afford that platform cost, right? And, for instance, Renderware, which we're not using, is anywhere between $100,000 to $300,000 per platform. So, you know, if we want to do the Windows one, a Mac one, and then Go Console and, you know, any consoles we wanted to support and Linux, you know, it's like Linux would have to be worth more than $300,000 to us. So.
Well, I think there might be enough gamers in Linux, the Linux world.
Well, see, then you get to the question of are they going to buy the Windows version and just pay Transvirtual anyway? So, I mean, gaming under Linux is not trivial. And also, you know, unfortunately, Linux game card support still sucks. Excuse my language. It's just terrible. So, you know, you're not going to get great positional audio, but you should, you know. You'll get good video support, though, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, X works pretty well.
Yeah, no, but that's actually more of a testament to the video card manufacturers and to John Carmack, right? John Carmack sticks with OpenGL. Therefore, every video game that any video card manufacturer that wants to support Doom 2, and they all have to because that's why people buy video cards, will support OpenGL. And supporting OpenGL means, hey, you know what? Things work out pretty good for Unix. So.
Well, I have only one other question, and that is, will I be able to drop 16-ton weights on people?
Well, you know, we're not making Tune the video game. Well, that's actually a whole different question than you realize you're asking. So there's this thing called player killing, right, where players kill other players, right? And so how do you make an environment where people who love killing each other can play in the same world where people hate being killed by other human beings, right? So, you know, because, you know, for instance, you'll be able to fly around in our game. So you'll have a 16-ton plane that you could have ran into somebody. But if that person isn't a player killer and doesn't want to be bothered by player killers, you have to make sort of an experience that both people enjoy, but you won't be able to do that to that person. Now, if they were player killers, then you could very easily just ram them with your plane or whatever. So you'll have an opportunity to ram people with big 16-ton objects.
What if you're a player killer that likes to kill people who don't like player killers?
Too bad. I mean, really. And it's like, it's actually a bigger problem than you think, because suppose you have enough player killers around who just want to harass non-player killers, right? You could conceivably surround them or dig ditches around them or something like that, right, and intimidate them. And so we have things in the game that prevents things like that from being effective, right? So it's really kind of a problem, right? Now, but the cool thing about it is player killers are pretty happy in general killing other player killers. And non-player killers are fine with them doing it as long as it doesn't, you know, screw up their game, right? So we've spent a lot of time figuring out how to make a world where both can exist.
You could always build prisons.
No, we couldn't, because people aren't going to pay us $10 a month to stay in prison. Unless it's like a whole different kind of video game that
we're
not making.
You have virtual San Francisco.
Well, that's going to be one of the starter cities, is San Francisco.
Yeah, virtual San Francisco, where all the peaceful people can live.
Yeah.
Or you could do New York City, a la what's the name of that movie with, where it's a prison.
Oh, you mean Escape from New York or whatever?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Now, you said you had a near beta that...
No. We have a technology prototype internal to the company.
Technology prototype.
Yeah, that we're showing around to investors and stuff. And that's... It's not the game by any measure. It's just... It's the beginning of what the company can do in a short amount of time. So
when do you anticipate actually having something in the form of an alpha or beta?
We're calling beta actually homesteading, but you'll find out why in about a year. The idea is that we should hit beta probably August of 2005, is my guess. Maybe September. We need about 3 weeks from going gold to ship, right? And we want to ship in time for Christmas. So
Christmas 2004.
2005. Right.
Okay.
We're talking real early right now in sort of the development of the game.
Oh, it's a brand new company.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So it's back to the VCs, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, I met a bunch of them when I was at VA, so that's kind of handy.
Well, yeah, you were pretty successful at it, weren't you?
Well, it matters how you define success. A lot of people wouldn't say that VA is the greatest experience from a raising money standpoint, but a lot of people would, you know. So
yeah, in terms of the ability early on, heck, it wasn't your guy's fault that the .com bust happened.
Yeah, there are people who actually feel that way, though. That's the thing, you know.
I mean, had the .com bust not happened, VA would be one of the high roller companies in the country right now.
Yeah.
I have no doubt of that. But you certainly had a very successful run with the VCs and the IPO. That was for damn sure. So I trust you're not going to have any problem repeating that success.
Yeah.
It's nice to be connected, I guess. So.
Well, you know, it's just one of those things. You just have to work at it. You know, the thing is, most VCs aren't interested in games, so finding the ones that will actually hear you out is kind of interesting.
You see this going further than just gaming, though.
Yeah, we do. You know, we're building a company here, right? But, you know, a lot of people still won't talk to you if you're attached to gaming, because, unfortunately, gaming has a pretty poor reputation for making money and losing it fast, so... You know, we just have to work on that reputation.
As I said earlier, I think there's some possibilities in the simulation area.
Yeah, well, there is, absolutely. You know, and actually, my background was before VA and before Tandem was in the government. So,
I remember a game that came out. This was actually one of the first, very first Windows games that came out in Windows 1.0. And it was attempted to do some political modeling.
You're probably thinking of Balance of the Planet or Balance of Power by Chris Cross.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. It was only available in Windows. It came on two floppy disks. And I was... I saw that back in... This would have had been in the 80s.
There was a ton of...
Well, this was particularly good because it did political simulation to some extent.
There's a ton of early BBS games that were political modeling.
This was a product. I mean, you could buy it. Yep. It even made the news because of where it went in political modeling. I mean, there was news reports.
There was also Balance of the Planet was more of an environmental. The Balance of Power was the big one, and there's another one called Guns and Butter, which a lot of people played, and that was fun. So.
Well, we are up to the time, sorry to say. I'm really glad that you have stopped by today, Chris. And periodically, let's have you back again, get us updated as you make progress. And come the time, Christmas 2005, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, come Christmas 2005, we're going to have a Reconstruction LAN party. On the Linux show.
We'll turn loose the IRCers, the TLS IRCers, loose on your servers.
Sounds great.
That would be fun.
Great. Well, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. And I'll stick around on IRC for a bit. So
I'm sure they'll appreciate it. So, on behalf of the whole crew here, it is 20 after the hour. I'd like to thank you all for stopping by and visiting us once again on our weekly episode of The Linux Show. Russ, who's our guest next week?
Well, I'm still trying to lock that in, so I prefer not to announce it because I have
a firm commitment,
but it's looking interesting, folks.
Yeah, well, it'll be posted on the website in a few days, so check it out then. On behalf of the whole crew here, again, we want to thank you all for stopping by. Keep supporting us, and we'll keep bringing you the show every week. So we'll see you all back here next week. This has been The Linux Show for
February 11th, 2003. We are out of here.
So you need an email server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? No, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.
I'm a glum one. It's explainable. I met someone. Unattainable. Life's a bore. The world is my oyster no more. All the papers where I led the news with my capers now will spread the news. Superman turned out to be flash in the pan. I've flown around the world in a plane. I settled revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I have charted. Still I can't get started with you. On the golf course, I'm under par. And all the movies ask me to star. Got a house that's a showplace.